There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that is a roundup of the best bits from today's show, Tuesday, the 18th of February.
Big story, DP World deciding to delist, to quit the Nasdaq Dubai after 13 years. They say Sultan Mintaleim is the chairman and he says the following. He says, the stock market is obsessed with short-term performance, revenue and profitability, but it doesn't suit our business. You say, we are making medium and long-term decisions, and that might mean you have a few quarters where the profits don't hit the targets that you want. So as long-term investors, we don't really care about that. We care more about the 5, 10, 15-year horizon. But it's the quarterly earnings report that is the be-all and end-all for a stock market investor. So he said, that's it. We've had enough. We're going to go private. And not the only local company having challenges with the scrutiny that a stock market listing brings. For example, you've got NMC Health. A lot of their problems stem from the fact that they are now a listed company. Muddy Waters, the investor in the United States, started making accusations about their financials. Scrutiny, the problem. Drake and Skull, again, listed company, has been since 2008. All kinds of corporate governance issues there. And the scrutiny with being a public company is absolutely intense. So we've been asking, what are the, and it's not, it's happening globally as well, Tom. You had some stats earlier, didn't you, about Germany and the United States, about how the number of listed companies is falling.
Yeah, since 1996, number of public companies in the US has almost halved. Similar figures over in Europe, where since 2000, number of listed companies has dropped by 37% in Germany. It's down 23% over in the UK. And this is delistings increasing exponentially, but also IPOs dropping at the same time. So is there a trend there? Is this something to do with an illness within the stock markets, a lack of attraction towards the stock market? Or does this decline merely mirror the evolving nature of the global economy? Discuss.
Well, we've been discussing it with a range of experts, including Muhammad Ali Yassin from Al Dhabi Capital, veteran investor in these parts. And he was speaking to producer Shruti about this. And she asked him specifically about the NMC Health case. Yesterday, the founder B.R. Shetty, forced to resign as a director from the company that he founded back in the 1970s. Is that going to deter other companies from listing on stock markets? And this is what Muhammad told her.
When you have investigations or when you have stories like this in markets, that's never a good sign or a good, and really affects the credibility of the markets where it's listed in. But also these companies, we have to remember, when they came into the public markets, they achieve a premium there for the original owners who sold it. I mean, this company has, at one point, the share price was above £40. At one point, the holders were considered billionaires. This would not have been achieved keeping it as a private company or an LLC in the small market. So there are always pros and cons, but going to public, that increases the transparency requirements, that increases the visibility, and public shareholders, when you become a public company and you get shareholders coming in, you could have some active ones or like hedge funds, and those will present challenges to your ability to manage or of the companies if you are not doing it at the highest standard of transparency and compliance.
It's the voice of Muhammad Ali Yassin, a veteran investor. But what about the chief executive's view? We're talking about the problems of being a listed company, but many of them, of course, have a very, very successful tenure there. Let's look at Aminat, the healthcare and education company. Now, it was created a few years ago to invest in assets, and it's bought some perfectly good ones, hospitals, schools, universities. And a couple of days ago, we learned that their profit for 2019 increased by 40% to 60 million dirhams. Now, we're going to hear in full from the chief executive, Tristan de Boysen, in a few minutes' time about how they did that. But just before he left, we said, you're the CEO of a listed company. Give us the pros and cons of being listed. And this is what he told us.
The main pro is that you have access to a large pool of investors. And if you are doing well and if you want to raise more capital, then you can tap to your market. In terms of cons, you have to make sure that in terms of governance, transparencies, you know, policies and procedures, you are very strong. And that's why many family-owned businesses, instead of going directly to the public market, look forward to have investors like ourselves, institutions or like private equity firms investing and helping them transition to be a listed company.
Just on that point of governance and reporting requirements, is there anything in the suggestion that people not take for granted sort of the responsibilities of an IPO, but don't really fully understand the obligations, the element of have your cake and eat it. It looks like a great idea to have an IPO, but then once you've got the burden of those constant obligations, the costs that are incurred, it can become quite burdensome for companies, which can well be in their infancy or haven't had that sort of stricture until that date. Is that a problem when it comes to sort of reporting requirements?
Well, it is. And we had Nasser Saeedi in the studio, didn't we? Dr. Nasser Saeedi, about half an hour ago. He, among other things, set up HOCMA, the Corporate Governance Institute. And the phrase that I remember from him was that the regulator has to crack the whip a little bit more. But he said, ultimately, it has to come from inside the company. It has to be the managers and the board of directors have to fundamentally believe this. And the inference being that some of them don't fundamentally believe it, that you can get the money and not have to subject yourself to that level of scrutiny. Praveen writes in, he says, becoming a billionaire by getting investors' money is not a big deal. And you're right, Praveen. They give you the money to invest it. You have to then generate the profits consistently and give it back to them in the form of dividends and buybacks. You make a valid point.
Got some really good text messages coming in on this very subject throughout the course of the morning. Thank you very much indeed to those. Thanks to Tien, who got in touch with us. I will paraphrase Tien, if you don't mind, on this one. Going public these days, you need to have confidence. That'll do. With social media around, if one employee says something, the world knows about it, even if the message has been twisted. Best thing ever DP World did is you don't need to list to make money. Thank you very much indeed for that one.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking nuclear power.
Yeah, talked commodities just a few moments ago. Let's continue that conversation now with all things energy. As we reported in the first hour today, the UAE's first nuclear power plant has moved a step closer towards starting operations. The Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation, FANA, has issued an operating licence for Unit 1 of the facility located in Abu Dhabi's Al Dhafra region. Nawa Energy Company has been granted the permit for 60 years. So what does this mean for us consumers, and how long will we have to wait to see the new facility being fired up for atomic energy here in the region for the very first time? It will be the first commercial nuclear power station in the Arab region. To tell us more about it, we're joined by the Director General of the Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation. Krista Victorson joins us live on the line. Krista, thank you for your time this morning.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Obviously, more than a decade in the making for this new plant and much anticipation ahead of it. What does this latest operating license mean in the move towards the opening of the facility fully?
Yes, thank you. So you are absolutely right. It has been in our focus for a number of years, so we have made a rigorous review of the application from the Nawa Energy Company on their wish to start operating Baraka 1. So after this long review, we have concluded that Nawa Energy and the facility they have built and started operating is ready to operate. It means that they will now start loading the nuclear fuel into the reactor and then progressively start producing electricity to the benefit of all of us.
Krista, in terms of that benefit for all of us, obviously there is a reliance at the moment from gas-fired powered stations. What impact, once Baraka is up and running with all four of its generators, could it have on our energy consumption?
A significant impact, in fact. The four reactors, when they are fully operational, will deliver a lot of electricity. Each reactor will deliver 1,400 megawatt. So with the four, it means up to 25% of the needs of the country.
Obviously, huge costs incurred in the development, the building, the safety, the security of this plant. How long will it take to pay for itself? How long before we see economic viability?
So that is not really up to me to talk about. It's mainly for the company itself. But what I can say is that there are high capital costs in the beginning in order to build a nuclear facility, nuclear power plant. As you mentioned, there are a lot of systems and there are a lot of protection to be in place. But then for the operation itself, it's much cheaper. Then you have just to replace the fuel that is consumed. So every 18 months or so, each reactor will stop for a few months, will reload one-third about of its fuel, and then restart again after some inspections as well that we will oversee.
Christer, obviously safety and security is paramount for the industry worldwide, and none more so for you opening a new facility here in the Arab region for the first time. What lessons have you been able to learn over the course of the last decade of development and learning from other incidents related to peaceful nuclear energy in other parts of the world?
So the important lesson that we have learned is that not only the reactor design is important. Important is also that we know the features of the location, the site where the power plant is located. And in the case of Baraka, we have analyzed very thoroughly the risk of earthquake, the risk of tsunamis, the risk of flooding, the risk of sandstorms. And all of these are not going to make harmful effects in Baraka. Baraka is very well protected inside the Arabian Gulf. We have very little seismic activity on this side of the Gulf. So we can safely give the license to Baraka to start operation. Another important lesson is that the operating crew is so important that they are very well trained, they have the right attitude, we call it safety culture, that they always think safety first, that the leadership has the same feeling for the importance of safety. So all these things are lessons that we have learned during the many years of operating nuclear power plants in the world.
Christer, much appreciate your time. Congratulations on the license and the operating permit. Looking forward to speaking to you again soon. For now, our thanks to Christer Victensen, the Director General of Fana here in the region, as we get ready to the opening of the UAE's very first nuclear power plant in the very near future.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Looking at some of the big newsmakers, producer Nonny's with us in the studio. Morning, Nonny.
Good morning.
You've got a story that I know Malcolm would have loved. Oh. It's a story about this.
Australia, what's your favourite sport?
Football.
Snack?
Pies.
Animal?
Kangaroo.
And what's your favourite car, Australia?
Holden.
Let me see, that's football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, huh?
Right.
Well, you sure sound like Australia to me.
We are.
Well, then you better tell me again, because I just might forget.
We love football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars. Football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars.
That's football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars.
Football and meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars.
I think you better tell me again.
What makes every Australian?
But Holden cars are no more.
Unfortunately, no.
What's the story?
General Motors is dumping the brand Holden cars after 160 years, and it is indeed an Australian icon. Every family was either a Ford family or a Holden family.
Have you heard of these things, Tom?
I have in passing. I am aware of them. I am not aware of their 160-year history, however.
Peter Brock, was he a Ford man or a Holden man?
A who?
Peter Brock, touring car champion of Australia for many years.
Again, who?
I thought you knew sports.
I do. I'm not great
not
on
touring
sports.
Cars.
Yeah, touring cars is also pushing it a little bit
far. He was a Holden man.
Could tell you opened the batting for England, 1981 all the way through to 95. But
can we get back to Australia?
Go.
So, yes, football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, no longer Holden cars. That was a jingle that was created for the Holden brand. Apparently, I only just found this out, it was a copy of a Chevrolet commercial from the States, which included apple pie and such in it.
Oh, I get you. But it was much beloved of Malcolm Taylor, and he would be sad to see the demise of Holden cars. Staying with transportation, Tom's muse maker is this guy. Rocket Man or Jet Man?
Yeah, not Elton John. He's not very well at the moment, is he? He's got a bit of pneumonia. He's got taken off stage by an aide earlier on this week. But I'm talking about Vince Rafay. He's the name you need to know. That's Jetman from X-Dubai. Obviously, sponsored by X-Dubai, Skydive Dubai, and all the team here at Brand Dubai. A video posted over the weekend by Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed, the Dubai Crown Prince, hailing the team behind the first autonomous human flight held in Dubai. Nothing new there. We've seen Vince Rafay with his rocket suit doing bits and pieces in the past alongside planes and all. This one was different, though, because this was the first time that he's taken off from a standing position up on the runway at Skydive Dubai. Jumeirah Beach Residence is where he headed to. He got up to about 1,000 metres in 30 seconds at an average speed of 130 knots. So this represents a breakthrough. The three-minute flight was punctuated by the roll and loop, no less. And then he opened his parachute before landing back at Skydive Dubai. All controlled from the ground, the equipment enabled Jetman Dubai to reach speeds of 400 k's per hour, as well as hovering, changing direction and performing loops. Why big news? Because of that fact that he was able to take off from a standing position, not be thrown out of an aeroplane or jumping off a cliff in his suit. And this is part of the initiative ahead of Expo 2020 Dubai to have autonomous human flight. So Iron Man is no longer a thing of the films. He could well become reality.
And this is all Expo, when they open the doors, you say this is going to be our ketchup.
This is our ketchup. You know, this is our Eiffel Tower. He said you can have your steel structure that sits on postcards for hundreds of years. You can have your popular condiment that sits on tables or in annoying little sachets around the world. Get rid of the sachets. Mm-hmm. We are going to deliver autonomous human flight. This is our gift to you, world.
He is our newsmaker this morning.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The Lebanese economy at risk of implosion. That's according to the World Bank. Let's get more comment on that now, if we can, from a man who is in a perfect position to do exactly that. The founder and president of Nasser Saidi and Associates, former chief economist and head of external relations at the DIFC Authority, and the executive director of Halkama, the Institute for Corporate Governance and Madeira Institute of Directors. More than that, he's regularly been listed as one of the most influential persons in the Arab world by several publications and organisations. And he was also the Minister of the Economy and Trade and Minister of Industry of Lebanon between 1998 and 2000. Absolute pleasure to welcome into the studio Dr. Nasser Saidi. Dr. Saidi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
I want to first ask you about a certain promotion, if I may, before I'm going to let Richard delve into all things economy over in the Lebanon in a few moments' time. For a man who has sat at the very top table for the Lebanese government as a finance minister, what does it take to become a finance minister? The reason I ask this is that I think I'm not alone being a little bit surprised by the United Kingdom's latest Chancellor of the Exchequer, the top man for finance in the country, is a 39-year-old, someone who I didn't even know about last week. Now, have things changed in politics in terms of taking up top jobs in governments?
Oh, I think the case of the UK is a very interesting one because he's going to face many challenges. We have Brexit, and of course, he's got to deliver on the Conservatives' promise of a new Britain, right? And new horizons. So if you want to be at the top table, it means you've got to be both a visionary politician, you've got to be a master of finances. As Keynes said, you also have to be a bit of a philosopher and a mathematician and therefore a master economist. It also means that, in particular at this time for Britain, where you're breaking away from the EU, you've got to give confidence to investors to invest back into the UK. The past 3 years have been one of very, very low investment in the UK because people have held back given Brexit. So you have to do two things. You need to restore investment in the UK, and that means the private sector has to buy into your government plans. It also means that you're going to go on a fiscal spending spree in the UK. Why is that? Because the state of infrastructure in the UK has been becoming decrepit. It's practically third world, a bit similar to the US. At the same time, you've got to look out for social care and the NHS. Both of those will require large spending plans, capital spending. At the same time, you've got to finance that. Boris Johnson certainly would like to have higher budget deficits, and I think we'll see that. But at the same time, you've got to deliver on taxation. You're going to have higher taxes. The issue is, where will those higher taxes come from? Will the Conservatives under Johnson be willing to tax the rich? So quite a bit on his agenda.
I think it's fair to say that Rishi Sunak has his work cut out. Rishi, that's over in the UK. Rich, what's going on closer to home?
Well, one of our top stories this morning is that warning from the World Bank when the officials were here in Dubai over the past couple of days, that the Lebanese economy is on the brink of implosion. Now, we've spoken about this before over the past few weeks and months, Dr. Saidi, but what's the latest in Lebanon and what, if anything, can be done?
Well, the warning from the World Bank is appropriate because you're facing a economic and financial meltdown. The numbers are alarming. Let me turn to the most important. Poverty rates. Something like 22% of the population is now below the food poverty rate, i.e. they're living on less than $2 per day. Mm. 40% of the population is at the poverty level, i.e. spending subsiding on $5 or less per day. And pretty soon, with an economy which is rapidly deteriorating, and when I say rapidly deteriorating, we're talking about an economic depression that Lebanon could be falling into, with GDP declining by 8 to 10%. That would mean that half the population would go into poverty. At the same time, you've got inflation now accelerating to about 30% per annum, accompanying the decline and depreciation of the exchange rate. The Lebanese pound has plummeted from 1,500 to the dollar to 2,400 just yesterday. Mm. That's about a 40% depreciation. And of course, that means that anybody who's got a Lebanese pound salary has seen that salary and income melt down by some 30 to 40% given the inflation rate. Now, what is the cause of all that? The cause of all that, of course, is Lebanon's large debt overhang. You've got debt, public debt, running at 160% of GDP. Debt service this year, if there are no reforms, is about $10 billion. Just to put that in perspective, that's about 22% of GDP just for debt service and 66% of government revenue. So those are the staggering numbers. As a result of all that, Lebanon has got to introduce deep reforms. It has to restructure its banking sector. It has to restructure its debt, undertake structural reforms, and hopefully get a lot of aid from the rest of the world.
Now, one of the problems that Lebanon has is those massive government debts. Another related problem it has is the energy industry and the energy sector, the conventional electricity generation. And Tom, we've had a question in about that issue, haven't we, about potentially green energy in the solution.
Exactly that. Yeah, somebody referencing the fact that Dr. Saidi is also the chair of the regional Clean Energy and Business Council and has been in touch with us saying, what benefits, Dr. Saidi, can Lebanon get from clean energy, be it move to solar, wind, electric vehicles? Will there be job creation and could it improve foreign currency reserves?
The answer to all that is yes. Lebanon, however, doesn't have the large surfaces like deserts that we have in the UAE. So what you have to do is to look at maybe solar and wind. There's plenty of potential there. But I think the big promise for Lebanon is going to be gas. Mm. As we know, we're waiting for oil and gas discoveries in our waters. Of course, that's going to be some 8 to 10 years down the line. But you can start using LNG from now. Electric vehicles are certainly part of the answer. And above all, I think at the moment, you need greater energy efficiency. We have highly inefficient old power plants that use fossil fuels that spew into the air, polluting the environment. We have one of the highest cancer rates in the world. So what you need to do is to think of how do you change the energy mix away from fossil fuels towards solar and wind. I think that, those are both promising. And, of course, start introducing electric vehicles and make the investments to support that. You need the docking stations, you need the power supply stations, and you need to put in the infrastructure for that. So a few years down the line.
Dr. Saidi, I would argue that Lebanon's greatest asset is probably its people. Mm. If you look at the Lebanese diaspora, within a kilometre of where we are in Media City and Internet City, some smart, capable, bright, innovative Lebanese people.
That's true.
And many cities around the world would say the same thing. How can a country with such talent face the challenges that it does? And what's the potential solution to get that talent to work in Lebanon for Lebanon?
You mentioned that in the introduction. You need deep reforms. They have to be political reforms, but also economic and financial reforms. The debt, as I mentioned, has to be restructured. That's a big burden. You need to cut about the debt in half. You need to reach a debt to GDP level of around 80%.
Does that mean that the people... Who does Lebanon owe the money to?
Much of it is owed to Lebanese themselves.
Right.
The very people that you're mentioning, the Lebanese diaspora around the world, transferred their remittances and savings into Lebanon, attracted by very high interest rates. And that went to finance government. Unfortunately, government used that for current spending, not for building up infrastructure, capital investment, education, and all the rest. As a result of that, they've wasted a lot of 3 to 4 generations worth of money. That is what we're facing right now. Now, can we rescue? The answer is yes. There are plenty of talents. We know what needs to be done. Will the politicians have the courage to turn to the Lebanese people and tell them there are hard times ahead? There are structural reforms we need to undertake. We're not going to be able to continue with economic largesse and pensions that they promised them. We're going to have to tighten the belt across the road, across all activities. And that will require two things. It will require the rest of the world to help Lebanon based on those proposed reforms. I estimate Lebanon is going to need some 20 to 25 billion from the likes of the IMF, World Bank, and other countries willing to help Lebanon. I call it an economic stabilization and liquidity fund.
A kind of Marshall Plan for Lebanon.
Like a Marshall Plan for Lebanon. At the same time, you need to restructure the banking system because the banking system has 70% of its assets in Lebanese government paper and central bank paper. That paper is no longer worth 100% of its value. It's probably worth only 50% of its value at best. So that makes for a big hole in banks' balance sheet. That means you need to recapitalize the banks, and we're talking about another 20 to 25 billion for the Lebanese banks, and that has to be done mainly internally with a little bit of external help. The optimistic point is we know what needs to be done. We don't need anybody to tell us what needs to be done. And we do have the talents that you mentioned. We are able to do it.
Let's hope that that happens sooner rather than later. Dr. Nasser Saeedi, can't let you go without asking you a question about the issue of corporate governance. You heard me rattle off our top business stories this morning. The challenges at Drake and Skull with their ex-chief executive Khaldun Tabari. The challenges at NMC Health with their founder B.R. Shetty stepping down. Lots of questions about corporate governance at both those organisations. You set up Hokama, the Corporate Governance Institute here, and ran it for many, many years. What do you make of some of the challenges we're facing in terms of corporate governance here, and what can be done about it? And I say that in the knowledge that it's probably 10 or 15 years ago when you set up Hokama that I asked you similar questions, and here we are 10 or 15 years later asking the same questions.
There's one institutional change I'd like to see happen. We need a company's house in the UAE. Mm. A company's house where all companies are registered, where they have to put up their financials, say on a quarterly basis, providing data so that the media and the credit analysts and everybody else can actually understand what's happening in those companies. I think that's one structural reform I'd love to see happen. That would make for greater scrutiny of both management and finances of those companies. The second, I think, has to do with a stronger enforcement of corporate governance, both internally and externally. What I mean by that is there's a great deal of weakness I see in many audit committees, audit and risk committees. They're virtually absent. You need to have independent people on the board and peopling the audit and risk committees. That's a big weakness. Too many boards have too many friendly people and relatives and honorary members. We can't afford that. When you're using public money, public investors' money, or even families' money, somebody has to be held accountable. And the board has to be held accountable. That means internally, as I mentioned, and having more independent directors, but also externally, by which I mean, I think, the Emirates Securities and Commodities Authority has to carry a bigger whip and use it much more frequently and enforce the rules, particularly for public companies. I think there's been progress in terms of that over the past 10 years, but in truth, the change has to come from within the companies, and that means that the boards have got to be much more active than we've seen before.
Dr. Saeedi, a great pleasure talking to you about a range of issues this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nasser Saeedi.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.